Welcome to Comically Pedantic, where we take a detailed look at the complicated concepts, characters, and history of comic book culture. I'm Derek L. Chase, and joining me on this episode, as always, is the wonderful Corinne Levy.
Oh, hi. It's me. My name is Corinne.
That is a very soft answer. I feel like I came on very strong, and you were just like, hey, how's it going?
I love the duality of co-host.
Yeah. Okay, so we've already spoken for like an hour before we even started recording. So yeah, I do kind of want to like
every time.
Yeah, I know. Let's start by just getting directly into Corinne. What is your bright spot?
You know what? After the whole hour that we talked, I did not even conceive an answer to this question.
I can give you one that's completely unrelated. So
yeah,
like,
sure.
if you want to have time to like,
yeah,
think.
Go for it.
All right. So you and I had talked about like some of the stressors in our lives and,
yes.
And some of the, like, there's some good stuff coming out of it too. But for me last week, I went on like a little adventure around town, actually in your old town. I stumbled into like a games and hobby shop. And, for anyone that is aware, I'm a huge Digimon fan, and when I was younger, I was really into the Digimon card game, and I actually learned how to play it, but it was really complicated and kind of sucked, so they stopped making it. But they relaunched it a few years ago as like a whole new game with new cards, new rules, all that good stuff, and apparently it's quite good. So when I wandered into this games and like hobby shop, I kind of got to talking to the guy that owns the place, and he offered to like teach me how to play this new game. So I have found a new thing to take all of my money and a new thing to take up my time. And for whatever reason, I'm very happy about that.
Welcome to the world of trading card games.
I mean, I've been into trading card games before. It's just that usually when I was much younger, and it was honestly like where I grew up, much harder to get people that were invested in the same thing.
No, I do love a trading card. I'm more of a Pokemon person for sure. I have like a whole binder of just Pokemon cards, and I've like made my own decks. I've like bought decks. I would love to find a place where I can play against other people. Because right now it's just Max and I play each other, and it's fun, but I need somebody else to kick my butt.
I can get some Pokemon cards and get started.
You should. It is a fun time. I highly recommend, if you want to actually play it, buy just a deck or like a build your own deck first.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm doing that with the Digimon thing.
Yeah, because the booster packs, they are really just for, like, once you have a solid deck and you have booster packs that kind of fit the generation or whatever of that's been released, that's when you can, like, swap everything out. Those are, like, the real gambling tickets.
Well, so, like, I somehow ended up with like a bunch of Digimon cards from this game, either through like just buying them if I see them out and because I like the artwork and I like the characters.
Yeah.
Or like I went to a Digimon movie a few months ago and they were giving out Digimon like cards as you walked in, like exclusive to like the movie.
Right.
So I have like a bunch of those, and then I'm buying like a starter deck. And then I'm just going to go through and, like, as I learn, swap some of the, because I probably have, like, 50 cards, but not enough to, like, make an actual working deck. Like, none that, like, fit the right.
Yeah, because you need, like, X amount of, like, a certain type of card and then X amount of like, another. So
I have a lot of, like, things that don't really go together.
Yeah, no, I get you, because like there are a lot of like people that make like gimmick decks, like it's supposed to do a specific strategy. I'm bad at doing that. My toxic game trait is that I play strictly off of vibes and what I think is a neat little guy. That might not mean it's the strongest card or the smartest way to play, but I just like looking at the cards. And I like having them out, and then I'm emotionally destroyed when my Pokemon gets knocked out. We're a little.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think when we're done recording, I'm going to run to that shop and I'll see if they have any Pokemon starter packs too.
Oh, they definitely do.
I'll get both.
As you should. It's a lot of fun. So I support this journey you're going on for your trading card era. Okay, I think my bright spot is I got to finally give Max his Christmas gift. I had gotten tickets for us to go to Radio City Music Hall and watch an orchestrated viewing of Lord of the Rings, like the Two Towers.
Oh, I wanted to do that.
Yeah, so it's like a 280 person orchestra.
Yeah. And
yeah, it's really great. We got to, so it was the second movie. It was the Two Towers, like the one with the giant fight scene at the end. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of great stuff happens in the movie.
That's my favorite, by the way.
I think Max has seen that one the most. And then I think it would be Return of the King and then Fellowship, I think. I don't know. But, so I was like, I got to make it a whole day because we're going to have to take a 2-hour train to get to New York. So, you know, we get on the train. I have made like dinner reservations to like a Japanese barbecue spot. Like, so you're like cooking on the table yourself. And like the food was really good. And then I had the route that I planned out made it so that like, one, it's not that far of a walk from the train station. So it was like, we got food. And then on the way to Radio City, there was the Lego store at Rockefeller
Center. Oh, yeah.
So yeah. I took him to the Lego store and I was like, you can pick a Lego as long as it's not like the freaking elf palace that's like $500. I was like, I will get you a Lego.
I don't remember the
price.
There's one that Austin really wants that's also like $500, but I think it's like a Hogwarts thing.
Yeah, there's like crazy Harry Potter ones. There's crazy Star Wars ones. Like, I know the Millennium Falcon's like huge.
Yeah, I kind of want that.
Yeah, and then there's like the big Lord of the Rings one. I think it's like Rivendell. I think that's what it's called. I can't fail now. I went to an orchestrated Lord of the Rings thing. I have to be a fan now. I was before. But anyway, I took him to the Lego store. He got a little brick heads of Gandalf and the Balrog. Like the weird demon that he fights in the movie. So got
him. Are those the ones that have like the bigger Lego heads, or is that something else?
The
brick, you know what I'm talking about? Because
they're like little figurine statues that are very like blocky, and they have like
I know what they are then.
Yeah, they're really cute. But I got, that was like a little, that was one little like box. So I got him that. I got myself some Lego flowers because I love to have a decorated toy.
Of course.
Yeah. And then we saw the show and we saw the movie. It was great. He had the best time. And that is probably why it's my bright spot. I love when a gift that I give works out so well. And like, he just was like so happy, and I'm like, "This is great! I championed this. Like, this is my
thing." I love that.
So I was very proud of myself.
We just recently went to Radio City Music Hall because I got tickets to see Taylor Tomlinson for Austin and Mine's anniversary, and it was a great time. It's like I think it's coming out on Netflix this year because it was like a recorded thing. It was a hell of a lot of fun. We had it was just great. She's wonderful. But like, you know, I just recently got Austin. I got Austin a gift and I got myself a gift. And they're both like events, which are usually not my type of gift. But I got Austin. Well, for me, I my personal gift was just, I'm going to see a show. It's like my favorite podcast. I'm going to go see these guys do a live performance.
It's really fun.
I'm looking forward to it. For Austin, I got us tickets to go see Manchester Orchestra again.
Oh, yeah.
This time in Brooklyn. And, like, there's no one else on the ticket. So, like, I have no idea. I think it might just be Manchester Orchestra for, like, the entire time.
That That'll be fun.
That's great. Like, I love that we have things that we have going on where we can actually, like, get out and do something versus being... I'm literally stuck in the room that I'm in right now because we're redoing our closet and I'm surrounded by things. So maybe I'm more excited about the idea of being outside than usual.
No, it's nice. It's nice to, like, get a break from something and, like, you know, I had bought these tickets in, like, November, so it was nice to, like, have it finally, like, oh, like, this is what I paid for. This is great. Because I couldn't tell. I was like, this is either going to be a great gift or it's just going to be, like, fine. But Max is, like, an experienced person all the way. And so, like, last year for his birthday, I took him to the Ren Fair. He had a great time. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to top that because, like, I took a lot of effort into, like, coordinating. And I'm not always the best planner. I'm usually pretty go with the flow. I don't, like, often make reservations for things. It'll be like, you know, oh, you know, we're going to go to this place and we're going to kind of hang around this area. And if we find something that's good, cool. But I, like, planned this out. I, like, planned out timelines and everything. I covered it. And I was like, this feel pretty cool. I did a good job. And, like, he was very happy. So that's, like, all that matters to me.
I'm very plan oriented. So, like, the idea of, like, doing an itinerary and having it go off flawlessly is, yeah, I totally understand. So last time we took a quick look at what Ben was getting up to over on his side of the Spider-Man books and what was supposed to be a sort of epilogue to Maximum Clonage. He was leaving town before getting pulled back into the superhero gig for one last job, while at the same time adding a little bit more mystery and depth to his longtime friend, Seward Trainor. This episode, we're going to dive into a two-part storyline, Time Bomb, and get a look at what's going on with Peter Parker after rededicating himself to Mary Jane and possibly even giving up on being Spider-Man altogether. So, before we dive in, I wanted to read a little bit of Glenn Greenberg's comments from The Life of Riley. He states, Time Bomb was designed by Spider-Man group editor-in-chief Bob Budiansky and the core Spider-Man writers to set the stage for the big switchover to Ben Riley. By now, I think all of you are well aware of my feelings about how the Clone Saga had become horribly overextended, so I won't belabor that point here. The one saving grace about the Time Bomb storyline was that it was only two issues long rather than the usual month-long monstrosity that spanned all four Spider-Man titles. And side note, as someone who has read it, I agree.
You know, as someone, like, because we're reading this in a different time in which these were sent out into the world. Yeah. I didn't really fathom the fact that each little segment that we've been doing per episode took a month for people to get through.
It was one issue per week, essentially.
Yeah, I, like, didn't, like, fully, like, yeah, because I was like, oh, yeah, like, issues get out, like, once a week or whatever. That is a month. I, like, didn't, I didn't comprehend that until you actually said that out loud. Because I've just been like, all right, I gotta take, like, 30, maybe 40 minutes out of my day to, like, read, like, fully read this and, like, see what's going on. Like, I'm not just going to skim it. But yeah, that's a lot of time for a reader to just be dragged through. So
it's also a lot of money because a lot of these books are usually published monthly. So if you're reading Web of Spider-Man and only Web of Spider-Man, you would only be paying for that once a month. But because of the way that they were publishing it, it was every book. And if you wanted to understand what was going on, you had to buy every book.
Yeah, that's just like a full-on weekly expense. Like, no, thank you. No.
Well, while we are on the subject of editors in the Spider-Man office, let's take a brief look at where we are in the behind-the-scenes nature of the storyline. Prior to Ben Reilly's return, upper management at Marvel had dictated that Spider-Man had to do something similar in scope to DC's Death of Superman storyline that had broken multiple sales records at the time. Terry Cavanaugh, one of the writers for Web of Spider-Man, had brought up the idea of bringing back the clone, and suddenly the ball was rolling. Many of the creatives on the books felt that this would be a good opportunity to restore Spidey back to basics, which they felt was sorely needed since the stories had all been dark and convoluted. In particular, they wanted to get rid of Mary Jane to help free up Spidey for more stories involving romance. Spider-Man editor Mark Bernardo had said that the story was supposed to end in Amazing Spider-Man 400, which would leave Ben Reilly as the original Peter Parker, allowing the Peter we have been following to leave with Mary Jane. Tom DeFalco, the editor-in-chief, approved starting the story and the Clone Saga had begun. And I don't think that that's crazy. I do think that a lot of the storylines prior to the Clone Saga had been really convoluted and dark, but I don't think that ended with the Clone Saga.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like still everything that we're reading is like convoluted and mildly dark. Like you've got Kane having premonitions of a woman's murder. You've got people questioning their identity and who they are, like, as a human being, if they even are a human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be done really well, but I think there's a fine line to walk, and they're not doing it. It keeps going silly and dark and silly and dark in a way that, like, it's tonal whiplash, at least for me.
Yeah, and because you can't even call it dark comedy.
No.
That's like a whole different tone in and of itself. No, it's not. Unfortunately.
But as the story progressed, Tom DeFalco came up with the idea to have Mary Jane be pregnant, which would help Peter choose to leave superheroing for a family life, which makes sense. That's around the time that Marvel hit a huge financial crisis and the company nearly went bankrupt. This all stems from the speculator market at the time, as well as Marvel's expansive catalog being so expensive. I'm not sure how much we talked about that before, but this is like mid-90s where everyone was buying every comic book. So like Marvel was just pushing out more and more, just creating this huge glut in the industry. But in reality, a lot of these people are only buying number ones or whatever, because they think it's going to end up being they're going to earn all of this money from having this like collectible, but not every issue is going to be a collectible. So as these people are buying up and realizing they're not going to get the money that they want, they're going to stop buying comics. And if you're expanding your catalog, you're going to eventually have a shitload of stuff that no one's buying and you're going to be out all that money.
Right. Because there's more than just being number one that makes something a collectible.
Right.
They talked about it on the Weekly Planet before, or maybe it was on a different podcast, but they were talking about, it might have been on Do Go On. I listen to a lot of Australian podcasts because I love the Weekly Planet boys and I love Nick Meso, and he just guests on a lot of other Australian podcasts, and I'm like, I gotta keep hearing this man talk. But basically they were talking about, it was the story of Superman comics and the people that had written them. And there used to be just so many of the original run, like, Superman comics. Like, so many of, like, the number one first appearance of Superman. There were so many of them to the point that they basically valued as, like, nothing. People were, like, using them to, like, fill in holes in their walls and stuff like that. Something has to be in so much. It has to be valueless. And then over time, when it then becomes reappreciated and there's so little of it because people were just using it as whatever, does it actually become a valuable collectible? So you can't, in my eyes, thinking from like an investment point of view, you can't just make something and think that it's going to instantly gratify the collectible value, because it hasn't been a part of history yet. You know? I think that's the most intellectual thing I've ever said in my entire life, and I can't believe it's on this fucking show. What a time. It's the sunglasses. Well, the sunglasses made me smart.
Well, because of all of what we just went over, the consequences to all of this is that DeFalco was fired from being editor-in-chief, and the comics were split into five categories, with Bob Budiansky as the editor-in-chief of Spider-Man comics. Mm-hmm. That's kind of around where we are, right? So after Amazing Spider-Man 400 failed to end the Clone Saga and lead into the Mark of Cain story, sales had actually started to climb for the Spider-Man series as everyone was interested in seeing what was going to happen next. At this point, Aunt May had died and Peter was sent to prison, so public interest was pretty high. Like, what can you do with this book
if this is where you're going with things? That makes it a more like valued and collectible thing. Again, like if you're making a bunch of number one things, it doesn't mean that the stories are going to be good. The thing also has to be like of quality or like, again, have some sort of major impact on like product or the industry. Like Superman, again, such an icon. So of course his number one is going to be like now of huge value. There's not a ton left and pop culture made him blow up. I never knew the Clone Saga existed. I knew who Spider-Man was, like, before this podcast. Because, again, he's a huge part of pop culture. So, but this story, over time, has just become so shit that it doesn't have a ton of value. So it's either maybe, or maybe, like, it's become just the worst that because it's so bad, people want to buy it now.
I do think that there is a something to be said there. I think it has to be an extreme,
though. It can't just be some mundane thing.
Well, you know? And I would say for Amazing Spider-Man 400, like, I have that comic. There is the only reason why
it has such a big impact. Like, that's where she died.
It had a big impact. I think that was really well written. And the only reason why I don't think it is more of a collectible is because there were so many printed. There needs to be a scarcity involved.
Yeah, people haven't shoved it in their walls yet.
Right.
So,
but because of the growing number of sales during this time where people were actually genuinely interested in what the fuck was going to happen, the writers were encouraged to keep the clone stories going. So now we have marketing and sales saying, like, you got to keep this going. You can't just stop here. So with Maximum Clonage, the intent was to finally wrap up the storyline and get Ben as the main Spider-Man for all the books. However, the story kept changing to the point that many of the clone storylines never actually concluded. Like we talked about Gwen Stacy, the Gwen Stacy clone was supposed to die, and instead they just wrote her out. So she's still out there somewhere. And like that's technically a dangling plot thread for this.
And we haven't heard from like Scryer or Judas Traveler in a while or
right.
You know, any of those. So what's up with them? Because they were, I guess, supposed to be like a big part as well. You know, they get Peter Parker out of prison.
I think that there is like something to be said. Like they could be a continuing threat throughout. But like, yeah, there's a lot of like weird stuff. Like you could wrap up the clones and then have Judas Traveler be like the next big thing. You know,
because he always talks about how he knows stuff, you know, how he knows like the bigger picture of everything. But then he just goes missing for a long time. And it's just kind of weird.
But this is sort of where we are now, with each book having their own editor and all Spider-Man books reporting to Bob Budiansky. And this will be the status quo for a while as Marvel tries desperately to figure out what they want to do. But, like, that gives us, like, you know, we had talked in a previous episode a little bit about, like, what the editorial, like, where we are with that. Like, we did have the editor-in-chief was fired. And, they did put a new editor in charge of Spider-Man. But it is, not a lot of it is coming directly from consequences of the storyline. Because as far as Spider-Man comics and, like, marketing is concerned, it's doing well because people want to know what the fuck is going to happen. It doesn't mean it's good.
It's so popular.
It just means it's selling well.
Yeah.
So that brings us all the way to Spectacular Spider-Man Volume 1, number 228, which is written by Tom DeFalco and Todd DeZago, penciled by Sal Buscema, inked by Bill Sienkiewicz, colored by John Kalis in Malibu Color, lettered by Clem Robbins, and edited by Eric Fine. We've talked a little bit before about Sal Buscema and Bill Sienkiewicz artwork not really meshing well. I'm going to keep bringing that up every time I have to read one of their books because it really doesn't mesh well. Buscema's blocky and cartoony style gets muddied and weighed down by Sienkiewicz's scratchy and extremely rendered inks. That's still the case here, but I do feel that there are several scenes that actually make more sense in this book than they normally do. Like that blend of styles kind of works. But it's sort of the same as like when we were talking about like Dr. Octopus's death. It's because of the nature of that story, not because of Spider-Man, but because of that specific story working.
Yeah.
This comic begins with Peter having a nightmare, which is part of why I think it works in this situation. Kane is chasing after Mary Jane. Peter tries to stop him, only for Kane to reveal that Peter is going to be the one to kill her, which causes him to wake up screaming. Throughout the next day, Pete keeps seeing the Jackal's image, which causes him to almost call Seaward Trainer, because he's like going like, oh no, what's going on with me? Seaward Trainer might know. But he's rendered unconscious from an intense burst of mental pain. That's when the Jackal appears and tells him that before he died, he had triggered a genetic implant that would command Peter to kill the person he loves the most. So it's like a hallucination. But you just see like the Jackal just suddenly appears before him.
Right.
Naturally, after hearing this, Peter goes home to wait for his wife. Because like, of course, you know, you're told the person that you're going to kill is the person you love the most. And so you go home and wait for your wife to get there. Like that's what you did.
Okay, now hold on a minute. Have you ever had a nightmare about your partner, like, and they do something that upsets you in your dream? Have you ever had? Yeah. Okay.
Now, I mean, I've had dreams where I've done the bad thing.
Yeah. Well, now when you wake up, sometimes, because I am a person who has very, like, vivid dreams. Like, sometimes I can, like, feel what's happening or, like, you know, the senses are too strong sometimes. Sometimes it's too real. Sometimes I have nightmares where Max says or does a really mean thing to me. And, you know, it feels real. You get upset. You get freaked out. And then I wake up and basically what I have to do sometimes is I have to, like, the only way I can kind of chill out from the experience is I have to talk to the person, not about the dream itself, but just have a conversation with them to get a vibe check on, like, who they are in reality again, to then be like, oh, it's okay. We're fine. That was totally a dream. This person is normal.
So I guess that makes sense. Like, wanting to try to, like, so maybe check in.
He's just like, I gotta get home. I gotta vibe check my wife. Make sure there's no immediate weird tension.
As Mary Jane gets home, Peter is waiting for her, like, in a dark room. And as soon as she, like, walks in, he yells at her to leave and run away. So she's like...
Okay, well, that is not what I'm saying to do.
Well, I can see things maybe changing for him. You know, like, you're, like, in a good spot, but then seeing her, you're like, oh, no, this is, like, vibe check has not passed. Like, we need to get out of this situation
now.
I've
got the murder feelings. My wife's gotta go.
Mary Jane is able to escape, and rather than call the Avengers of the Fantastic Four for extremely contrived reasons, she calls the New Warriors. She has apparently been reading their book because she knows Ben has been hanging out with them, and she thinks Ben is the only one who can help. The comic ends with Spider-Man finally catching up to Mary Jane just as the New Warriors arrive. So that's the end of part one. That's what we got.
Wait, so Spider-Man, so Peter Parker is now going after his wife, who he told to run away. I'm afraid I'm going to kill you. Why is he chasing her?
He can't help himself. It's like, it's just an urge that he can't stop.
To murder her.
To murder her. Apparently, according to the Jackal, it's like he programmed it into his DNA that upon... So essentially, when the Jackal died, he said a specific thing before he died, and that is supposed to be a mental trigger.
Okay. So like he actually does have a mental trigger. It's not him just being manipulated into thinking he's like a sleeper agent.
According to this comic book, yes. I'm assuming there's like some sort of some hypnosis or something involved. Okay. I don't know.
I don't know.
Now, the New Warriors' continued involvement with the Spider-Man comics is simply due to them like falling under the same editorial bracket that we discussed earlier. You know, right. Marvel being split into five different groups. You have Bob Budiansky in charge of Spider-Man. Somehow New Warriors got looped into that. And because of this, Ben has been showing up in their book and helping out. Continuing to have the New Warriors pop up in a Spider-Man book was just a simple way of getting them more exposure to readers. Sure. So, like, I mean, it makes sense, but it's kind of silly.
It's kind of dumb, but, like, okay, I guess.
Now, do you remember, and maybe not, but, like, a little while ago, we discussed Peter accidentally slapping his wife in a fit of rage?
Oh, yes, because he finds out that he's a clone, and he's, right. like, grappling with it, and he's grappling physically with Ben, but then Mary Jane steps in and, like, kind of caught in the crossfire, she gets, like, papad, yeah.
Right, okay. So this is one of those situations where, I don't know if you realize this, that was technically 2 issues ago. So that would be, like,
no.
2 months in real life. Right, but it's because of the way that, like, the comics are being told in parts over different issues. It was 2 issues of Spectacular Spider-Man. Oh. So, like, you know what I mean?
Oh, that's so weird. Oh,
it drives me crazy.
I hate now, how this whole saga is, like, set up. I think I've said it before, but, like, juggling the 4 different titles drives me insane. It's very weird.
Wait for a couple of episodes because it's going to get fun.
Oh, lovely.
Now, the reason this story, you might think it might be a little bit weird because, like, they had a huge blow up over the fact that he accidentally hit his wife, and that was, like, a big issue. And they didn't want to accidentally, like, promote, whether real or fake, like, violence against women.
Yeah.
This story is all about Peter trying to murder his wife. So that, like, you might think it's a little weird that this got published, but the actual reason for that is because at the time that they published Spider-Man 226 and that, like, being the story and, like, that becoming a problem.
Right.
This one was already so far along in production that they couldn't really change much about
it. Yeah.
Now, the one thing that they did change, at least according to Glenn Greenberg, was that they changed the cover of the comic book. Because in this one, it's like angry Peter Parker holding on to Mary Jane. But in the original one, it's like basically the same image, but he's holding a fist in one hand and then he's holding her wrist in the other. So it looks more violent, but they changed it a little different for this.
Okay.
But that brings us all the way to Web of Spider-Man, Volume 1, number 129, which was also written by Tom DeFalco and Todd DeZago. This time, though, it's penciled by Steve Butler, inked by Randy Emberlin, colored by Kevin Tinsley and Malibu Color, lettered by Steve Dutro, and edited by Eric Fine. This is actually going to be pretty simple to get through.
Cool.
This was, like, one of the fastest reads I have had, which is good because I technically read this months ago and did not remember a fucking thing about it. So I went back until I was halfway through this story before I was like, I've read this. I remember parts of this now.
Oh, yeah. I've been here before.
Now, the main story beats really kick in for the comic when Mary Jane runs into Ben. She quickly fills him in on what's happening with Peter, and Ben rushes off to try to stop him. Mary Jane tries to escape in a taxi, but because of the superhero nonsense going on, the driver runs away and MJ is forced to just get behind the wheel and try to drive the taxi herself.
Mm-hmm.
Ben can't stop Peter, so he instead relies on slowing him down to help Mary Jane get a head start. Mm-hmm. Peter chases her all the way to Aunt May's house, where MJ surrounds herself with photos of their family and, like, the years that they spent together. She tells him that she believes he can break the programming. But she forgives him if he can't, because she'd rather die in a house full of memories than anywhere else. Which is kind of sweet.
This poor woman.
Peter is overloaded by all the memories, and he breaks down crying in Mary Jane's arms. And that is the end of Web of Spider-Man, Volume 1, number 129.
Oh, great. Okay. So Mary Jane doesn't die yet.
She gambled on all of the memories being enough to, like, override whatever programming Peter had, and apparently that worked. He just started crying, and she comforts him, which
Wonderful.
Is pretty sweet. I mean, it's a very simple comic. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of running. That's all it is.
Yeah, I can picture that. Very, very chase scene heavy. Okay. Cool.
Now,
I'm glad Mary Jane's not dead. She is one of my favorite characters.
Same. Well,
probably is my favorite character in this whole...
Which is one of the things that I thought was interesting when they were talking about how they wanted to get rid of Mary Jane.
Yeah, that is kind of the weird thing, isn't it? Because she is the most compelling character, like, especially supporting-wise.
Supporting-wise,
like,
definitely.
She really brings down Spider-Man. And it's like, no, in you wouldn't book, have Spider-Man if you didn't have her, at least right now.
In the book, I see Ben and Mary Jane as being the most compelling characters. Like, I actually give a shit and I want to read about them.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating because not to like tip my hat too much, but in modern comics, I kind of hate both of them. But I love Ben and I love Mary Jane in this run. They make sense. They are genuinely good characters that their decisions are based upon like the things that they have gone through
mm-hmm.
versus just we have to have a thing happen.
Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense.
On the topic of Time Bomb, Glenn Greenberg had stated that the main thrust behind Time Bomb was to give Peter a reason to give up being Spider-Man and leave New York with Mary Jane. After all, the fact that he was apparently the clone did not necessarily mean that he had to give up the superhero identity he had held for the past years, which you and I had talked about in a previous episode. Like, why are they even bothering to say who gets to be Spider-Man? Like, both be Spider-Man.
The other thing that also, I don't want to, like, totally veer off of what you're going to be saying, but a question mm-hmm. that I've been having with the issue you just summarized, essentially, is Mary Jane runs into Ben Reilly in New York. So my question is a lot of, like, when is this happening? Because they decided in what we just, like, last episode that, like, Ben Reilly is the one that is supposed to leave New York. They right. decided that already, like, I guess in the time of the past, like, over a month ago or a month mm-hmm. ago. I don't know. And he does leave. He goes to Vermont. And I get that he had to go back to New York to help Dr. Seward. But it did not seem like he was there that long. And then he had just the side quest of the Vulture stopping. And it ends there. It's just, oh, I got to run back real quick. I got to save my friend one more time. You know, classic action style. So when is this happening? Is this before the weird
thing? Or I'm assuming it's after what you read. Because like,
so
timeline-wise...
He's like, oh my God, I just stopped the Vulture, man. I'm so tired. I'm just going to get a cup of coffee and leave New York. Oh, hello, Mary Jane. You need me to stop you from being murdered? Sure, I guess I have another 45 minutes.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure that's exactly like the way that it plays out. I don't know for sure. And I don't know if the editors were like passing notes on like timelines at the time. So it might have just been like they just assumed that Ben was still in New York full time.
Yeah, because that's the weird thing to me is they already decided this thing. I get that there was a sidetrack, like had to go back real quick. I would really have loved if it was like, Ben Reilly, you gotta help me. And he's like at a kiosk getting a hot dog. Just, oh, I was just getting a snack before I left, but anything for you, old friend.
Right.
I would have loved if they had maybe mentioned that he was on his way out, but had to stay again to help. But just mainly just so I could understand I've gone back to Simpleton. I had all of my IQ used for the collectible philosophy thing. And now I'm like, I don't know where we are. I don't know.
I think it's a thing where like you're just expected to sort of do the mental retconning yourself.
I guess so, yeah.
How does this fit in? I mean, there are there are places online that like sort of do a chronology of like when I'm reading the X-Men, I usually use an X-Men chronology like website that tells you like at what point does like a specific book take place, because even though it has flashbacks, or even you're supposed to know those flashbacks at that time.
Since the previous one, because sometimes sometimes it's kind of obvious, you know. Mm-hmm. With the last one, it was very much like it picks up pretty instantaneous between issues, because the Vulture thing was happening at the same time as the Doctor saving, and then he runs into the crime scene from the last issue. That seems pretty clear, and it's not like they really like stated it obviously. They used just mainly visuals and being, oh, here's a crime scene with evidence of the Vulture doing that crime of the last issue. So you could kind of tell, like, okay, this is like when it's happening. These things are very similar. Cool, got it. It's sometimes just in between the very big chapters where it's how much time has really passed? Because sometimes it feels like it could either be same day within a day or months.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm just, am I supposed to? And then they maybe mention something that happened in the months between that we haven't heard about, and it gets kind of weird.
Well, I mean, keep in mind, the original Clone Saga took, in real world time, it was 20 years prior to this. But in comic book time, it's 5 years. So
right.
That means that every book that was published within that 20 years has to fit in within a 5-year time frame.
Right, which is just, to me, sometimes super bizarre. But yeah. I guess that's just the way that publishing works, because you have book series, like full-on books, where it's just, you know, sometimes the sequel doesn't come out for years, but the story picks up where it left off, or, you know. But sometimes
Technically, the Harry Potter books all take place in the 90s, even though they finished publishing in the early 2000s.
Yeah, so. I think, though, with novels, oftentimes, though, when you have a series of books, I feel like they pick up better and giving you the context on where you're at. Because with Harry Potter, with the ones that I had read when I was younger, you knew, based on how they described the setting and everything and the activities they were doing, it was generally the book started, you know, the summer or a couple days before he was going into his next year of school. And with, like, Percy Jackson, you know, it started with, he's in this grade, this thing happens, he's got to go back to camp. So you can get a range of how old he is. You know, stuff like that. With, I read, like, James Patterson books a lot. You know, it's not the most, like, intellectual thing. They're very quick reads. But you know, like, this happened after this. It's in chronological order, and it's pretty, like, clear what wounds are fresh and what aren't, you know, stuff like that. Sometimes right. I just can't tell with the Clone Saga.
Yeah, I think it's just the way that it's written. It doesn't quite, like, and it could be because there are different writers, you know, on each.
Yeah.
Book, so you don't really have the same thought process going into like the events.
True.
But I want to get back to a little bit of what Glenn Greenberg had been saying.
Yes, because sorry. I just had that question.
No, I liked what you had to say. It's a good question, and it's a good thing to call out. It's just that he had been talking about how this was supposed to clear the way for Peter to leave New York and Ben to be the one taking his place, which we've now had like Maximum Clonage Omega kind of alluded to that. And then, The Exiled or Exiled, like that was also supposed to, but like in the opposite direction. So now we're finally like trying to get this done.
Yeah. In Exiled, they said, okay, Ben Reilly decides he's going to leave, because Peter Parker already has a family and, like, roots down here because he's married and having a child. So don't bother him with the stress of moving. Move this solo guy. that's what we literally talked about last episode. So it's weird that they're now just like, let's change it. Let's change the
I think the thought process was like Ben would try to be the one that like gives something up for Peter, but then it doesn't work.
Right.
And and this kind of, I mean, it makes sense. I kind of like that, and it kind of works for Ben's character, you know? Now, what Glenn Greenberg was saying, though, was that he doesn't necessarily believe that Time Bomb completely accomplished the goal of setting up a reason for Peter to leave. And I'm going to continue quoting him. Other than having Peter place MJ in jeopardy and have to overcome some retcon mental programming from the Jackal, there's nothing in this story that clearly leads Peter and MJ to decide to leave New York. At this point, though, I was just glad to see the light at the end of the tunnel and was looking forward to seeing the new era of Spider-Man begin. But the ghost of Age of Apocalypse was still upon us, and Marvel's marketing department reared its ugly head once again. Now, what Glenn means by this, we're going to cover in a future episode, because the Spider-Man books are about to get even more complicated.
Well, and then the other thing, I agree and disagree with what Glenn kind of said.
Glenn Greenberg?
Yeah. I agree in the sense that it's like they didn't really give they kind of gave a reason. You know,
I think it makes sense for Peter to say it's time for me to go.
Yeah, because he has so much association of being Spider-Man there, and the Jackal and Kane have given him so much trouble and have really explicitly jeopardized his outside life, kind of unlike, from my knowledge, other villains have. I think this has a more profound effect, maybe. I mean,
I would say the Green Goblin maybe is like the, and Green Goblin and Venom have like had a big impact on Peter's personal life outside of his superhero stuff. But that's because they knew who he was and did things to target those, like that aspect of his life. And so that's kind of what the Jackal's doing too.
Exactly. So, you know, and now that his wife is expecting, there's even more reason to kind of take a step back from. But that's the step back from being a superhero. And I guess, you know, if you're in the place where you constantly associate being a superhero, then there's a reason to move. But it's not as though they had a conversation or highlighted that. It was just, oh no, I got sleeper agent into killing my wife.
Yeah, I
that's
think...
crazy, but... You know, you also went to Pennsylvania where the Jackal used to live. So I guess it could have happened there too, but I
can see maybe wanting to just like get a new fresh start somewhere where things are a little different. And I can see this setting the stage for that. I don't think that they actually made that super clear in the book.
No, and I totally agree with that. Yeah.
I think that I don't know about your next reading, maybe that will be like an, or maybe it's mine, the impetus for Peter to say, fuck it, I'm done. And we're going somewhere else. Right. Now, the part about the Age of Apocalypse, I find really interesting because I didn't factor, like, I know what Glenn Greenberg's talking about.
And I didn't.
Well, I can give you, like, it's not a huge spoiler, like, story-wise what's going on, but it does change marketing about what's going on. Okay. We have coming up a relaunch of every Spider-Man book, but as, like, instead of Amazing Spider-Man, it's going to be The Amazing Scarlet Spider. And so each book is going to be retitled and given a new number one, for only a handful of issues, and then it's going to go back to being Amazing Spider-Man.
That, just make a Scarlet Spider line, in general. Why do you have to re-release stuff?
It's, the idea would be, because Ben is supposed to be taking over, it's going to be this huge marketing thing, like, say, Age of Apocalypse Alpha, or Maximum Clonage Alpha, where it's a big number one that you have to get, but then the, like, once you're done with those, I think it's 4 issues per book. Once you're done with those 4 issues, it just goes back to being Amazing Spider-Man, because you have like a certain legacy numbering there and you want Ben to be Spider-Man, not Scarlet Spider.
No.
But he's only known as Scarlet Spider right now.
I'm sorry, as an audience member and as maybe a consumer, that doesn't make sense. Like, I guess it kind of does, but it doesn't. It's just, I feel like it makes the reading experience more confusing.
You know what? I didn't actually think about this until just now, but like Austin and I are rewatching a lot of old Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And when I say old, I mean like the new Doctor Who, but from years ago. I've watched a lot of classic Doctor Who, and I still love classic Doctor Who. But in the newer stuff, we've been rewatching, because she gave up watching at a certain point, and I gave up watching way after that. So right. I was like, oh no, there's some really fun, interesting stuff. And we both really got back into Doctor Who with like Russell T. Davies coming back, having like a whole new thing going on. It's really interesting. So we're trying to like bridge that gap.
Sure.
But one of the things that I think is really interesting is that around season 6, season 7 of the new Doctor Who, they started doing webisodes of like tiny stories that would go into, like they would lead into the episode that was being released, or they would be things that happened between episodes. And it's funny because you don't necessarily need to watch them, but they do provide some context to like some of the story that's going on. Mm-hmm. And I just remember like getting to certain points and being like, wow, it feels like not a lot has like happened between these characters. And that's because they happen in the in-between stuff that was really solely online. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't give a shit to go and hunt that down. You're making it harder for me to get the full story.
Especially when like a lot of context is behind a paywall now. And mm-hmm. I don't know if their webisodes are behind like a paywall, kind of like when people get...
You know what? I didn't even think about it. It might be only on iPlayer, which you can't watch outside of England.
Yeah, so, and a lot of...
I don't know.
A lot of like podcasts and YouTube channels will do like similar things. It's, oh, if you want extra context on this thing, or you want to hear more details about the topic that we're discussing in this already detailed thing, go pay more money to, you know, to listen to it or to get more context. So you're like a true fan who understands all the stuff. I don't like elitist fandom situations.
No, where it's like, I mean, I pay
extra and extra just to keep getting kind of like almost what ends up making it a fuller experience. If you want the thing, if you want the product to be a good experience, make it inherently a good experience. And then if you want to add extra things as little treats, make them exactly that, little treats. That if people want
to
pay,
I was just about to say, there is a podcast I pay for to get the, like that added content, but the main, like the informational, educational, like higher brain functioning part of the show is free. It's the dumb, we're just going to sit around and talk about stupid shit that you pay for.
Yeah,
and I like the dumb sit around talk about stupid shit, so I'll pay for it.
Yeah, and that's totally one thing. I'm I don't know if I I don't know how many people listen to this podcast, and I don't know how many are fans of certain things. So maybe I'll keep my mouth shut, but I'll tell you later who I think about. It's a lot of people I think that don't actually need the money but are constantly trying to optimize by making something seem collectible when really, in fact, you're just totally ripping off your fan base. That is mainly who I'm thinking of. And I think a lot of marketing faces that have all the resources and the money are mainly the people that are doing that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because originally when I had put this podcast out, I had a Patreon set up and stuff like that too, in order to like get money. But that was because at the time it was a cost sink for me. I mean, it's still kind of a cost. Like, we don't make money off of this show.
No.
But the in terms of like what I was bringing in income wise, and the amount being paid in order to like keep our website up, keep the servers going, like things like that, it was a good percentage of my income, and it was like not necessarily incredibly difficult, but it was a thing that I would like, if anyone wanted to give me money in order to help that, absolutely. Also, some of these books are crazy expensive, but I found ways around that too. Mm-hmm. But as I, like part of my decision to take away Patreon and just go to like, if you want to donate a few dollars at like our, on the website, there's the like cup of coffee thing. Yeah. The part of my impetus to do that is I've started making more money, and I don't need it to offset our costs as much. And I think it's better if people want to be able to give me $2 to go towards server costs or whatever.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be locked into a subscription base, because like, we're going to give you this content no matter what.
No, and this thing is already like so casual, and
yeah,
like it shouldn't be an obligation to people who listen, or for, you know, comics, for people who read, if it is just a casual thing, you know,
yeah.
You shouldn't be under some kind of obligation, especially if the other side really isn't. You know,
absolutely.
If it's all voluntary and like, that's fine, but silly, silly stuff.
Well, I mean, so we've talked about Time Bomb and we've gotten into a bunch of different things. I don't really have much more to go over. Is there anything you want to add to this?
I just can't believe we did this in literally 3 minutes under an hour. I'm so impressed with us.
We finally figured out a method that works for us. And this was,
I know, and it only took us less than half of the Clone Saga, which is still quite a bit of Clone Saga.
All right. So I'm just going to wrap things up then. You can find more information at comicallypedantic.com. You can also follow us on Instagram by searching at PedanticCast. New episodes come out most Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and at comicallypedantic.com. If you have any comments or questions, you can send them in text or audio recording to comicallypedantic@gmail.com. Please indicate if you'd like your name or question read on the air. And don't forget, we still own fuckcomicsgate.com if you'd like to send a donation to the games and online harassment hotline. We will be back soon with another deep dive into the world of comics, but until then, you can find more exciting adventures at your local comic shop.